This is Gabfest Radio, a weekly program about politics and culture from Slate and WNYC. On this week's Political Gabfest, President Obama tries to circumvent Congress with executive action. Will he succeed? Is it a smart strategy? Also, House Republicans have a new plan, sort of, for immigration reform. I'm David Plotz.
And I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Culture Gabfest, Philomena, the dark horse contender for this year's Best Picture Oscar. Then, Scott Stossel's new book, My Age of Anxiety, examines not only his own phobias, but the role of anxiety in the 21st century. And then, the broad new Comedy Central show about broads, Broad City.
Ugh, I love this song. Ugh, this is a slave song. It's not a slave song.
It's widely known by the black community that What a Wonderful World is like a slave song.
Right, right, right. I totally forgot that you're like the voice of the whole black community.
We'll start with the Political Gabfest right after the news.
Hello and welcome to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. I'm David Plotz in Washington. President Obama delivered his State of the Union on Tuesday, and if you're like most Americans, you've already forgotten what he said. Is the State of the Union speech obsolete? Then a few House Republicans have a plan to pass immigration reform, but not give citizenship to undocumented immigrants. Does it have a prayer of getting through Congress? Joining me in Washington is Slate's chief political correspondent, John Dickerson. Hello, John.
Hello, David.
And from New Haven, Slate senior editor Emily Bazelon. Hi, Emily.
Hey, David.
President Obama's State of the Union gripped the nation this week. At least 75 or 100 Americans tuned in to watch the president offer a list of proposals that have no chance of legislative passage that will be forgotten by next week. So, John Dickerson, the major proposals in the speech, the major proposals are minor proposals. He was going to raise the minimum wage by executive action for federal contractors. He's going to use executive Use executive action to raise the fuel economy standards for heavy trucks. He's going to regulate power plants. He says he's going to regulate power plants. He created a new kind of retirement account, which has the MyRA, which is just, I think the IRA, the Irish Republican Army, used to call itself that. He's going to exhort people to hire the long-term unemployed.
Right.
It was the New Deal. It was not.
Well, a couple of things. I think part of your derision stems from the fact that he and his aides had spent the previous 2 weeks talking about how, frustrated by Republicans who won't cooperate with him at all, he's going to grab the tools of his office and fully engage in the executive actions that are available to a president. And they set expectations for action really high, and they kept saying about how he's got a pen and a phone and a mansion and a yacht. He's got a pen and a phone, and he's going to, you know, do all these great things. So then you listen to his speech, and it was basically a thoroughly conventional speech in which the big things, immigration, tax reform, changing the earned income tax credit, help for the long-term unemployed, a minimum wage increase, trade authority, all of those things require cooperation with Congress, which he had spent the previous 2 weeks telling us he thought was a dead letter because he'd never get any cooperation, so he was going to go have to do these other things. Nevertheless, he talked about all the stuff he wanted to do with Congress. Then he did talk about those executive actions he was going to take, and as you pointed out, they're puny. What he can do is so circumscribed, and my favorite example is on this minimum wage hike from $7 to $10.10, is it's for new contracts, and that's because the authority under which the president is making this is the authority that the executive has to make governmental contracts more efficient. And so in this case, a company that has a federal contract will be made more a new federal contract. They say it will be more efficient for them to pay more, arguing that studies have shown that you retain workers longer. But if they were to undo existing contracts, which are usually done on a 5-year term, it would be so disruptive they couldn't make the case that raising the minimum wage is more efficient. So this shows you how he's kind of parallel parking these tiny little acts of his executive authority within the statutes, which is the legal thing to do. But it also shows how incredibly circumscribed he is by his office.
So, Emily, did you come away thinking, well, he's making the best of a really bad situation and these executive orders are and executive actions are, you know, the best he can do. They're a good effort. They set a standard. Or did you come away thinking this is what a waste of time and effort?
Well, I just find the State of the Union generally so tedious and irritating. It puts me in a bad mood, and so that doesn't make me inclined to give anyone the benefit of the doubt. You know, I mean, I'm not generally in favor of presidents using executive orders with hugely expansive goals, because that's just not really what our democracy, how it's supposed to work. So it's not like I think he should be doing tons of things he didn't mention. I think, I guess, two things. One is that the most important executive action he is taking surely has to do with carbon emissions and the EPA and how the EPA regulates carbon. And that was already happening. It's not new. I'm glad that it's going on, but that seems like the most significant thing. The second thing I'd say is that immigration reform, which we are about to talk about soon, seems like where he really could get possibly some participation from Congress. So that's important. And then I also think, and I think, John, you said this last week, maybe, just that he is doing his best to start a real national conversation or keep one going about income equality and pre-K and the minimum wage. These things that, as a Democratic president, he's really well positioned to make this a strong and cogent argument. And even if he doesn't get to be the person who claims the legislative success, maybe down the road that will happen. And if we go back to his New Yorker interview about writing one paragraph in a big book of history, then you could argue that he's sort of planting the seeds for that now.
So Jeff Shessel, who's a former presidential speechwriter, had an article, I think maybe in the New Yorker online, where he said, you know, if you're going to do these executive orders, if you're going to take executive action, at least take it on things that will be hard for another president to reverse. So
Yes. The
minimum wage is a good example. I actually think this is a pretty good idea. It would seem really Scrooge-like and miserly for a future president to come out and reverse what Obama has done on the minimum wage for federal employees. Now, it's not to say it's impossible, but it would seem hard. Another example that Obama didn't do, but that Shessel pointed to, would be to bar forms of discrimination against gays, lesbians, transgender people, which I thought those forms of discrimination
already are
banned.
In federal employment.
I mean, I think forms of discrimination, forms of human rights, could probably do something around disability as the president with executive action or affecting federal workers that would be hard to reverse. If you have a legislature which will not cooperate with the executive branch, such that there really is no significant room for legislation, is this nibbling along the sides a reasonable approach?
I mean, it's fine. It's just not going to get you where you're supposed to be going if you're Barack Obama and you have very grand aspirations.
Should Obama, like, then demand the introduction of legislation, which will fail? Demand the introduction of legislation, and will fail? I mean, is that a better strategy? I mean, we have a Congress that will not play. So what's his job?
I think that's right. I think his job is to do both, basically. And he's not so overtaxed by the things that he's going to do through executive authority that he wouldn't also have a little extra time to do some other things. And I also think that just one of the things that we are grappling with in the beginning conversation about this is the disconnect between his claims for action and the pebbles that he was throwing at some of these problems. These problems being the disparity between those with great wealth and those without it. And the EPA example is a good one. It's somewhere where his legacy will be vastly improved if these regulations go through and if they stick. But those don't actually have anything to do with what most people care about, at least as far as the polls talk about it. So it's good for his legacy, maybe good for the planet, but not dealing with what people tune into a State of the Union. Many people tune in the State of the Union or tune into politics in general for, which is some kind of sense that the things that worry them are going to get better. The thing about making it hard to undo, the theory behind this is just that one, David, which is that on some of these programs, if the president does a little something, the manufacturing hubs are the best example. There is this theory that if you do regional government public-private partnerships with innovative companies, if you give them a little seed money, you can create a culture where innovative companies can thrive. And the president's only been able to set up two of these. He asked for 15 in his last State of the Union. But he's been able to set up two. And the idea is if he sets up two, he's now going to set up six more, that maybe they will gain a constituency. And what will happen is members of Congress will look at them succeeding and say, hey, this is a good idea. We'll implement it. This is the way the Peace Corps started. And so that's the hope. It's a big hope. And also presidents can kill this stuff pretty quickly because it's in the bowels, some of it, of executive contracts. And so it can go away. And that's, of course, the worry for any of these things is that they go away in 3 years if another president doesn't like them.
So, John, you talked about people tuning into the State of the Union to hear this or that. Now, as it happens, the smallest audience since 2000 tuned into the State of the Union, but it was still 33 million people. So it is, on the one hand, the number of people who want to hear the speech has gone down quite a lot. On the other hand, 10% of Americans, and probably, you know, significantly more than that as a percentage of American voters, tuned in to hear this speech. Yet, I would argue this is quite literally the worst kind of speech anyone ever gives on a regular basis.
Because it's a grab bag?
It is a grab bag. It is way too long. It's infinitely long. It's larded up with these kind of ceremonial clapping that's irritating. The nod to heroes is irritating. The dutiful...
You had me until that one.
The dutiful invocations of America's strength and the strength of the economy is irritating. The kind of partisanship of it's irritating. The putting without a theme quality of it is incredibly irritating. And the fact that it's inevitably forgotten is irritating. So I just implore the president to change up how they're doing it. There's so many different ways you could do this speech. You could not give the speech at all. You could, I think I said this last year, you could do it as a TED Talk. You do 18 minutes with video presentations, music.
Imagine you said that last year and they still haven't taken your advice.
If
they'd done it my way, they would have gotten a lot better attention for their speech. They would have been able to get people a lot more interested in it than with what they did.
Somebody may have even written this piece this year, Emily.
Yes.
I challenge any of those. I challenge someone to figure out how many of those 33 million viewers lasted more than 3 minutes.
Like, why, Emily? Why don't they change it?
Oh, don't look at me. I can't stand the whole thing. What I hate the most.
I know you can't stand it, but why don't they change it? Why not? Everyone hates it. There's no. You could not find a defender for this.
Because there you go. Say that again, Emily.
I think they are simply scared. They don't want to take a risk.
Yeah. He's a second-term president. He's a second-term president at low ebb.
That's
why does it matter?
That's why. If you can't change. As someone argued in Slate this week, if you can't change this totally boring, hidebound speech, which you're not compelled to even give in public, if you can't change it and its form over which you have total executive control, well, I can't remember. But anyway, you got a lot of control. You could fix it. And if you can't, if you're not creative enough to fix the speech, then we have to worry about your creativity and all the other ways in which you're totally stymied, which is one of the big problems. But I agree. One little thing the president could have done is said, you can go to whitehouse.gov for all the statistics about the State of the Union and see how far we've come, and you can check out all this other stuff. But tonight, we're just going to talk about the fact that in America, the distribution of wealth is just one topic.
Great.
The way, as Will Dobson, our colleague, suggested, and then I put in the piece, the governor of Vermont said, I can talk about a lot of things, but I'm going to talk about one problem that's happening in Vermont right now,
heroin.
Which is heroin addiction. And, you know, that simple focus alone would have changed the coverage. And if you, like the president, think that this issue is the one you should spend the rest of your administration and your time in Washington on, then perhaps focusing the speech and at least changing it structurally like that would give it that kind of a change. And the fact that they don't do anything creative or interesting,
you know,
is...
Can I make a bet? I'm going to bet his last one, he will not give that same speech. He will
Nixon
give it totally
he'll
different
finally do
kind
the
of speech.
TED Talk version?
Well, Nixon and Carter went back to issuing them by paper and just didn't give them at all. Each did that 1 year. The best thing was looking back at the original coverage when Wilson did it for the first time in public in 112 years. The headline or the subhead for the piece, I think it was in the Post, that said, Washington is amazed, because nobody had done it for 112 years. And the notion of a president coming down to talk to Congress was like such a huge thing. People were, they were all a Twitter before Twitter.
But there was a Twitter. Coming up, is the new Republican immigration plan heartless or brilliant? You're listening to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is Gabfest Radio. I'm David Plotz, along with Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, and this is the political Gabfest portion of the show. Let's move on to our next topic. Immigration reform, favored by President Obama, passed by the Senate with a very strong, nearly 70-vote majority, stalled in the House, where House Republicans, basically refused to take up the Senate bill. They would offer what many conservatives perceive as being amnesty to our 11 million undocumented immigrants. It is, however, widely agreed upon within the Republican Party that this is an issue that the party has to get correct on before 2016, because they are bleeding support from Latinos. There is a sense that it's a party of unwelcome, that is unwelcome to anyone except white people at this point. So some of the House Republican leaders are coming out with what's called not a bill, not a law, not anything specific, but a framework for a House bill that might at least satisfy donors that they're doing something about immigration, even if it couldn't pass. So, Emily, what is it that the House Republicans are considering doing?
Well, it sounds like what we're talking about is not a path to citizenship, but some in-between way of legally living and working in the country that would probably be tied to security benchmarks, and lots of talk of, you know, the border and fences. And what I find confusing is the notion that if you really had those benchmarks and they were kind of about national statistics, that people's individual fates would be tied to this national set of events and progress or lack thereof that they would have no personal control over. That seems really odd and grating to me for the people involved. Whether citizenship is crucial to people who are already here as opposed to something that they care deeply about passing on to their children, you know, so that part of it, I can't tell whether that will be a deal breaker with the Democrats or not. John, what do you think?
I mean, you're right. That's the crucial question. Will they be allowed to basically the 11 million who are here and are undocumented, will they be allowed to stay, or will they in some form, or will it have to be citizenship? What interests me is on this question of security and metrics. One of the ways to kill the idea of permanent status for the 11 million is to make the metrics for security so high the status march never kicks in, because,
right,
you know, it'll be that the border has to be secure so that, you know, no human walks across it. I mean, it won't be that bad, but it'll be pretty bad. And so then we'll have a huge debate about the border. And the reason that is good for those who don't want to seem like they're anti-immigrant is they'll just say, well, I'm pro-security and this isn't secure enough. And so they can, it just allows them to say this is an issue of security, not an issue of whether you like people with different color skin or not, which is what, you know, some people would argue.
Right. So the two key differences with Democrats in this Republican bill, just to review, one is that while Democrats essentially believe that all the 11 million should be put on this path, those among them who've behaved properly and are, you know, willing to take the necessary steps should be put into legal status essentially very quickly and without there being a lot of preconditions on it. The Republicans believe there should be significant preconditions having to do with security of the border and how well we're doing in keeping out new undocumented immigrants. That's one difference. The second difference is that Democrats believe that the 11 million who are then put in legal status should also be put on the road to citizenship, whereas the Republican bill as currently conceived says not necessarily, no, that the children who are brought here as children should be put on the path to citizenship, but that the 11 million don't necessarily automatically go into that path, although there's some fudging about whether they could then come in as brothers or sisters or parents of people who are legally immigrants and become citizens that way. So House Republicans appear to be testing the waters with this. They're floating this as a proposal. They want to see what the response is, and what are they going to do? What are their possible options?
They were at their annual retreat this week, and what they're basically doing is testing the waters with their membership to see what kind of a revolt they will get. And there are those voices in the Republican Party. The National Review made this case, and I feel like
the Weekly Standard, or Bill Kristol
at the Weekly Standard made this case, which is don't touch it. We're doing just fine. The economy is not moving fast enough. The president's approval ratings are terrible. Obamacare will continue to be a great political winner for us. Let's not have this big family fight that we always have about immigration, because it will hurt our party's chances. And it's basically going to be an issue for John Boehner and the leadership in the House to try to kind of shepherd this through in a way that doesn't cause legislative momentum to ever get what's created in the House in a position that it would then go to conference with the Senate. Because if it goes to conference with the Senate, which is more liberal in terms of those who are here undocumented, would ruin the House bill, according to many Republicans, and the whole thing would fall apart, because they would have to be joined, and the more liberal Senate part would
take. Wait, does that mean Boehner basically wants to get a bill but not to actually have to pass a law?
Well, that's right. I mean, I think he wants to look like he did it in earnest. Well, no. Strike that.
Appearances are important here.
Yeah. Strike out the first part. You could imagine an argument where they say, we want to look like we're trying really hard, and it falls apart for legitimate reasons, so that we get the benefit for looking like we're doing it, but it falls apart because the Democrats won't go along or something. But I think there are a lot of business interests, for example, huge, and then also a lot of evangelicals, which are powerful in certain districts, trying to push their members to pass some kind of immigration reform. And so I think Boehner would like to get there. It's just a question of how bloody and ugly it's going to be. This legislative path would be to pass little things one by one by one by one, and then hopefully get the Senate to pass them. That's its own tricky problem.
So one question I have about the Republicans is whether this is a matter of timing. I mean, would the people who are saying don't mess with success feel differently after the election? Because the demographics for 2016 are so different from 2014 in terms of who votes, in a way that would make more sense for Republicans to try to court Latino voters.
Can I give you some of my favorite statistics that make just your point, Emily? So there are 108 majority minority districts in the United States. that members of Congress are going to run in, Republicans represent 9 of them. The average Republican House district is 75% white. The average Democratic House district, 51% white. Okay, so there are just 24 House Republicans who represent districts where the Latino population is 25% or higher. And of that, basically 12 are districts that Mitt Romney won by more than 20 points. So they're in, like, Texas. So the point is that there is very little incentive for House Republicans who think about getting reelected to their own district to do anything that would seem bigger, broader, more minority-facing, so forth. Then that all changes going into 2016. The problem, Emily, with that, I think, is that once you get into the primary process where everybody's competing for different notches of the Republican constituency, you have exactly what happened to Mitt Romney, which is somebody...
Self-deportation.
Yeah, he starts talking about self-deportation. Boom, gone. Party totally defined by its nominee's most extreme statement during the primaries. They don't get anywhere. That's the problem of waiting. You would hope to try and adjudicate all this in some fashion beforehand so that everybody kind of settles on something before you get into the primaries.
Can we talk about this philosophical question about whether a bill, a law that allowed undocumented immigrants to become legal residents with status to work here but could not become citizens, whether that is an acceptable law in the spirit of America?
No, David, is your premise here that these people have all jumped the queue by coming over the border illegally and there are all these other people waiting in line?
No, I didn't begin with a premise. I mean, this is sort of what the Republicans say. There's a Republican view, which is, okay, even if you're going to let these people work legally, that you don't want to let them jump in front of other people, that you don't want to privilege their illegal behavior by letting them become citizens. And it's different for children who are brought here involuntarily. It's different for everyone who's born. But that these people, they may have a way to become citizens, as I said, if they can become citizens as the parents of somebody or the children of somebody who's a citizen or by some other fashion, but they can't become citizens just by dint of having been here, come here illegally, overstayed their welcome. That we want to take them out of the shadows, allow them to work legally, make society more clear and functional in that way, but that we don't want to allow them the greatest privilege of living here, the privilege of voting and being citizens of the society. I think that's wrong. I think that's a basically wrong decision. I think it's a mistake to have large groups of people who live in your society who can't be citizens, who don't have the right to the franchise, who aren't full citizens. But it's a pretty minor wrong. I would totally accept that as long as we're clear that the children brought here involuntarily get the path, and as long as we're clear that the children of these undocumented immigrants are themselves citizens. I mean, where you get in trouble is countries like Germany, which used to not allow people to be citizens even after generations of living there. I think it's okay, but Emily, I'm interested in your take because you're a morally righteous woman.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm also a pragmatist. So I guess for me, this is about I'm more in favor of citizenship. I think the people who live here in the long term should be recognized fully as citizens, and also that actually it's, as you were saying, it's better for the country because that makes them fully invested in the good of the nation. It's just the more permanent, legitimate, authentic way to be here. But one of the reasons I feel open to no citizenship is that being a first-generation immigrant has just always been horrible and sucked. And you kind of do it and have this tremendous dislocation in your life for the good of your children. So continuing that tradition as rotten as it is for the people who have to experience it doesn't seem that alien and foreign to me. It's like steerage, you know?
Oh, man, that was a good one. It's steerage.
Permanent steerage.
That'll do it for the Political Gabfest portion of the show. You'll find a longer version of the show with more topics at slate.com/podcasts. I'm David Plotz in Washington. The Culture Gabfest starts right now.
This is Gabfest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Slate Culture Gabfest, Philomena was a nice little Brit import, and then it got nominated for a Best Picture Award, so we went and saw it, and we will discuss. Broad City was a nice little web series, and then it got picked up by Amy Poehler and Comedy Central, so we watched it, and we will also discuss. And finally, anxiety. Is it an enabler, a crippler, a disease, or is it just the human condition? Joining me today is the human condition herself, Julia Turner, who's also secondarily the deputy editor of Slate. Hey, Julia.
Hello, Steve. I feel like I should be responding in like 16 voices at once, like those throat singers who can sing multiple notes, if I am in fact the whole human condition. But I can't do that. So hi, Steve.
You know you can, human condition. And joining us as well today is the merely human Dana Stevens. Hey, Dana.
Hey, Steve.
All right. Well, let me throw some verbosity at you and ask you to respond. Philomena is the new movie from director Stephen Frears. He of The Queen, My Beautiful Laundrette, High Fidelity, on and on. It's based on the book The Lost Child of Philomena Lee by a British journo named Martin Sixsmith. It stars Dame Judi Dench as an Irish Catholic woman whose toddler son was taken from her by the church and given up for adoption pretty much against her will 50 years earlier. She's now teamed up with a journalist played by the wonderful Steve Coogan to find out the fate of her child. The film was nominated for a Best Picture Award. Dana, answer my questions in any order you see fit. First, was that nomination a surprise? I believe it's being treated as a surprise by the press and a little bit by us. And then I'm curious, are you a Frears guy?
Well, as for the nomination, I think the nomination probably, not to be unfair to the movie in any way, but just in terms of Oscar politics, is kind of a filler nomination. I mean, I don't think anybody thinks that this is a serious candidate for Best Picture, probably. As to whether I'm a Frears guy or gal, I mean, he's a very talented filmmaker. I think this is a pretty conventional movie that doesn't hit a lot of really surprising notes cinematically. But yeah, when he's got his game on, he's great. The Queen, I think, is a superior movie to this, you know, but this does have a similar kind of appeal.
I'm still reeling and recovering from this movie. I don't know how you guys consume pop culture as parents. Any kind of pop culture that has anything to do with the death of children or the separation of children or the loss of children. I just have like a massive, inchoate, gaping hole sense of woe that was my response to seeing this movie. I had to go see it for the podcast. And my husband asked his mother who'd seen it, like, oh, is it too depressing? Should I not go? Or she's like, it's sad, but it's not depressing. You should go. And then we both, like, came out of the movie utterly shattered. And we're like, we need to wake up our children and see them because this is so sad. So very strong emotional response to the movie. And then as I was mulling it over afterwards, I was thinking to myself, I can't tell. I think the story, you know, and it came out of a piece of journalism by this guy, Martin Sixsmith, which, great British name, by the way, is mesmerizing and fascinating and horrifying and terrible. The movie as like a case through which to present the story seems very solid, but does it transcend the power of the story as a movie? I'm not totally sure. I didn't necessarily feel like the movie's meditations on the themes of faith and skepticism were particularly interesting or thought-provoking. I felt like mostly the movie did a good job telling a fascinating and very, very sad story.
Well, it feels also to me like a piece of social advocacy in the sense that, you know, it's the true story of a woman who was one of many thousands of Irish women who was sent when she became pregnant without being married to one of these Magdalene laundries. There's actually a great Irish movie called The Magdalene Sisters. Did either of you see it from 2002? That follows a bunch of similar, you know, based on true stories of these young teenagers who were essentially imprisoned and, you know, enslaved in these convent laundries for years to pay off the debt to the sisters for having hidden their children.
Yeah, the whole story is amazing. But before we move further in the discussion, why don't we listen to a clip? This is where the journalist Martin Sixsmith, played by Steve Coogan, first really sits down with Judi Dench's Philomena, and they start to get to know one another.
So, Philomena, how are you?
I'm all right. I had a hip replacement last year, Martin.
Right.
It's much better than the bone one I had before. Yes. And it's titanium, so it won't rust.
Oh, it's a good job. Otherwise, I'd have to oil you like the Tin Man.
Is that right?
No, I mean, you know, like the Wizard of Oz.
He's just joking, Mum.
Well, let me begin by saying I enjoyed the movie quite a lot. I thought the performances were terrific. I mean, Dame Judi Dench could phone this one in and do great work, and she didn't phone it in. It's quite a good performance. I like her meditations on the nature of sexual shame and forgiveness. I thought those were quite good. But what I liked best about it was the meta story, in a way, which is about him writing the story about her, which focuses part of the drama on Coogan. And he repeatedly has to make phone calls to his editor to re-interest her in the story. And those are salacious and mercenary. And over time, he begins to feel guilty about that. And it becomes less a film, at least to me, about whether she will find her son, and more a film about whether he, the journalist played by Coogan, will exploit her search for her son. And I thought that that was really intelligently handled. The only other thing I can say is that, you know, this movie kind of hit home for me because this is a very similar set of circumstances to my own life. I mean, I was given up by a mother who was shamed into doing it. And I thought this was an affecting and honorable treatment of the subject.
Oh, my God, Steve, I had forgotten that. Now I feel like an idiot for, you know, telling you all about my husband's and my totally hypothetical woe at the confrontation of this tale. Did you know that going in?
No, I had no idea. I literally had no idea what the movie was. I was like, oh, another, you know, gem-like British import, you know, Oscar season special from Stephen Frears. And I thought, ah, what's it about? I have no idea. I'll go in and just, I literally saw the movie blind. And, you know, 10 minutes in, of course, I was, you know, reeling a little bit, enraptured a little bit, pleased, dismayed. I mean, kind of a whole palette of emotions, because that's very, very close to my mother's story. I mean, it took place in the United States, but she was sent off and made to disappear completely. So the pregnancy was not a public fact in her home community of Poughkeepsie, New York. And yes, anyway, so there's no need to pursue that any further. But I, as someone for whom this was very close to home, I thought this was a truly an honorable and not at all maudlin treatment of the subject. Not at all. I really thought it was a good film in that regard.
Yeah, a confrontation that they have with one of the nuns near the end, and this isn't spoiling anything about the search for the son and the discovery, but there's a moment that they return to the convent where she was, you know, essentially had her child stolen from her and sold to another family. And there's a confrontation with this nun at the end that was really quite complex, I think, in the way that it struggled, you know, with questions of faith and forgiveness and unforgiveness and, you know, repressed rage. And they both have very different reactions to the nun. I thought that scene was powerful. It's a very unusual character for Judi Dench to play as well, because she always sort of plays someone worldly and sophisticated and with a drop-dead, icy wit. And here she's playing this simple woman, really, this very simple, pious, uneducated woman. And I thought she was incredibly believable.
I felt like she was pretty believable, but there were a few moments where she was doing like Daffy Little Old Irish Lady, where you could just feel all of the intellect of Judi Dench like pulsing beneath the twinkling Daffy Irish Lady who's recounting the, you know, romantic novels that she reads to the exasperated journalist, where you're like, come on, lady.
Dumb it up a little.
I didn't totally buy Judi Dench's Daffy in those moments. But no, she does pull off a very atypical performance. They're both atypical for the two lead actors. I don't know. I felt like the performances and the personal responses to these series of events that they depict were great. But the movie seems to strive to create a larger arc of questioning around notions of faith and skepticism that I felt like it didn't quite add up to me. Did you guys feel that it did?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's being perceived by some critics as an anti-clerical screed, and particularly the New York Post critic, who I guess is a Catholic and was offended by the movie, just really savagely attacked it for being this, you know, one-sided anti-clerical screed, which was not how it read to me at all. What do you think, Steve?
Yeah, Dana, I don't see it as an anti-Catholic screed at all, and for the exact reason you cited previously, which is that final scene, and I won't give anything away, which seems to me an intelligent, multi-layered, very subtle take on her relationship to the church, her belief, and to a gesture of forgiveness. So no, not at all. I think that's a silly throwaway from a hack with an axe to grind. All right, well, the movie is Philomena. It stars Judi Dench and Steve Coogan. It's directed by Stephen Frears. It's at the Plex now, which is where I saw it. Go check it out. Let us know what you thought about it on our Facebook page, facebook.com/culturefest. Coming up, are we living in the new age of anxiety? You're listening to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is Gabfest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf, along with Dana Stevens and Julia Turner, and this is the Culture Gabfest portion of the show. If you'd like to find links for the things that we mention on the program, well, we collect them. We collect them on our show page just for you, wnyc.org/gabfest. And please, while you're there, leave a comment. Tell us what you think of us. That's wnyc.org/gabfest. All right, moving on. The web series Broad City premiered in 2009, and now it's transitioning to the bigs. It's graduating to half-hour, scripted, and weekly on Comedy Central. It's also produced by Amy Poehler. The show was created by and stars Abby Jacobson and Ilana Glazer. All right, well, why don't we listen to a clip from the show? In this particular one, Jacobson and Glazer are trying to put together a little scratch in order to go see a Lil Wayne concert. And to that end, they put an ad on Craigslist, and lo and behold, all of a sudden, they're cleaning some guy's apartment naked. All right, why don't we listen?
Ilana, I'm not going to clean this man's apartment. Touch his things in my underwear.
This is the last thing. We are so close. We are going to be friends with Wheezy. I'm going to f*** him, dude.
Who's Wheezy?
Little Wayne. This is the whole thing. Listen, it is for 1 hour, and he's giving us $200.
No, I can't. This is gross.
What would you be doing instead? Watching Breaking Bad and eating a Smart Ones?
Okay, it's a cashew stir fry, and I was, like, really looking forward to it.
I don't want to hear it, okay? You're losing your edge, and I wasn't going to say anything, but you're not as fun as you used to be. Guess I'll clean this dude's apartment on my own.
All right, well, let me add very quickly, that's Fred Armisen of Portlandia and Saturday Night Live fame playing the perv in that particular segment. Julia, what do you think of this show? Does it survive its leap from DIY to the big leagues?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like probably technically Comedy Central is somewhere between a web series and, say, the big leagues of, like, NBC's Thursday night comedy lineup. I think it's an environment that allows for shows to be a little bit more experimental and scruffy, and this show has a scruffy quality to it. But I thought it was really funny. I thought these characters are really compelling, and the actresses are great. And I felt actually that there's an exaggerated realism to the show such that these young women and their experience of New York feels almost more recognizable and real to me than the ostensible realism of the lives of the girls on Girls. And I was very impressed. And then I was pretty surprised to read some reviews of the show in preparation for coming in to do this segment that were very mean, including this somewhat extraordinary paragraph from Alessandra Stanley's review in The Times, which read, "It looks as if it could almost be a rough early draft for Two Broke Girls on CBS, sort of a crude, transgressive, and poorly typed treatment that one producer kind of likes and that the network rejects out of hand." If that is an actual...
Nice.
Yeah, burn, right? If that's an actual vision of the development process at CBS, then no wonder they end up with really terrible comedies like Two Broke Girls. To me, this felt really fresh, interesting, and exciting. What did you guys think?
Yeah, that was very meanly put, but I sort of see Alessandra Stanley's point. I mean, this didn't quite feel finished to me. I agree the two comedians are talented. I mean, I guess a part of it is just I just feel that this area of human experience has been aptly covered by the entertainment of our moment. I think that I understand that white 20-something young men and women in Brooklyn are funny and have hard times, and that story is being told a lot of times in a lot of ways, and that's coming from a huge Girls fan. But I don't think it's really quite fair to compare this to Girls because it's more of a sketch show. It is more of a Portlandia or a Key and Peele almost, and under that rubric, it's pretty funny. It could go places, but I agree that it needs a little bit more polish and maybe a little bit better writing.
I guess that's what I objected to was I feel like, you know, sort of in the era of prestige television, right, we all know what a prestige drama looks like, right? It looks like True Detective. It's very crisp. It's beautifully shot. There are brooding men in it. There's dead naked women. Like, we know what that means.
Terroir TV.
Terroir TV. I don't feel like we've quite figured out what prestige comedy is. I mean, I guess 30 Rock was the most impeccably reviewed and critically lauded comedy of recent years. And I think probably also the Danny McBride show Eastbound and Down on HBO was another one that got endless plaudits. But there is this sort of creep towards dramedyism in the prestige comedies, right? Like Girls is a comedy, but it's not like punchline after punchline. And then there's, you know, things like Brooklyn Nine-Nine on network TV, which are trying to be more traditional, but also are not like really gunning for the laughs. I mean, I laughed a lot more watching the pilot of this than I did at the pilot of Brooklyn Nine-Nine. And I think there's got to be room for comedy and comedy. And this show is pretty funny. Like, I don't mind if it's a loose bundle of sketches. And I found, yes, this is incredibly well trod territory. Would I prefer these girls to be, I don't know, like undergrads at UT and the show set in Austin? Like, that would be great. But to me, their attitude and insights and jokes about kind of putting one over on the world felt fresh and new, even if the environment did not.
Julia, I'm just going to have to go against you on this. I think maybe half a floor out of the Tower of Respect has been removed. But I think that this show is asking to be graded on two simultaneous curves, and I wasn't willing to grade it on either one of the curves. The first is that it's still supposed to retain enough of its kind of scruffiness and shagginess around the fringes so that you don't think of it as a kind of fully finished product or something that's overly polished. Okay, whatever, we'll give you that. Comedy Central's a pretty big deal now. Not really willing to quite go there with it. So it's lost what DIY credit had, to my mind, or enough of it that it doesn't get by on its raffish charms anymore. And then the second one was more important to me, which is that it seems to me this is a show about how friendship is a conspiracy against the rest of the world, and everyone else in the rest of the world is kind of an annoying twit outside of the friendship. But of course, that itself is a defensive pose on the part of people who kind of are fending off the realization that they're just huge losers, maybe even bigger losers than everyone else in the world. And if you believe the last part of that bit, then the conspiratorial friendship is enormously charming. If you don't believe it and you don't believe that they believe it, if you think that they think that they're cool kids, then the show is an obnoxious disaster. And I think that that's what the critics are picking up on, that these two, they do not think of themselves at all as these stranded 20-something white chick losers in New York City. They think they are so frickin' funny, and everyone else is kind of a loser and a twit. And that's the energy I think that people find a little bit toxic, and critics are not buying it.
I think you are out of your mind. They are totally in on the ridiculosity of their own characters. There are so many jokes in the pilot where they are the butt of the joke.
Yeah, I heard the jokes. The jokes are clearly there. It's a question of imputed belief. And I'm just completely, I'm sure, projecting onto the show. But to me, that was my experience of it.
See, I don't hear that mean-spiritedness in it at all. I do appreciate that it's about female friendship and that it's about two women who are sort of definitely outside the norm of the TV woman in terms of their look and also their kind of degree of grooming and hygiene and respect for social rules. So I actually like the characters they're playing and I like the friendship. It just honestly doesn't quite feel to me like it's written enough or it's polished enough. I think this is kind of a common trend in comedy right now, that there's these improvisational moments that are kind of kept on the first draft. I mean, now I'm quoting Alexander Stanley without even meaning to, but it feels like they're doing some rough sketches and some improvisational ideas that could turn into a well-written show, but there needs to be another pass at the writing.
All right, well, moving on. I've abandoned dates, walked out of exams, and had breakdowns during job interviews, plane flights, train trips, and car rides, and simply walking down the street. So writes Scott Stossel, the editor of the Atlantic Monthly, in the January and February issue of the magazine. It's an excerpt from his new book, My Age of Anxiety, Fear, Hope, Dread, and the Search for Peace of Mind, published by Knopf. He goes on to say, on ordinary days, doing ordinary things, reading a book, lying in bed, talking on the phone, sitting in a meeting, playing tennis, I have thousands of times been stricken by a pervasive sense of existential dread, been beset by nausea, vertigo, shaking, a panoply of other physical symptoms. In these instances, I have sometimes been convinced that death or something somehow worse was imminent. Dana, I'll start with you. We've had the Great Age of the Depression memoir, culminating, I think, in some ways with Andrew Solomon's book. And now I've noticed in my own life, just completely anecdotally, that anxiety seems to have replaced depression as the default quasi-medical description for what besets people in modern life. The three of us read this excerpt from Scott Stossel's book, and we've all thought about anxiety both in the essay and our own existences. What did you conclude from this?
I guess I would say more power to Scott Stossel for writing this book. If it helps him, as he says, he wrote it in part as a therapeutic effort to work through this anxiety problem that's plagued him his whole life and that he's tried all kinds of medical and non-medical interventions for without much success. I'm not sure that this excerpt made me want to read the entire anxiety memoir, because there's something going on in this memoir that I have a feeling would get on my nerves at larger length, which is that he somehow conflates his own symptomatology with these larger theories about cultures. Things like you just mentioned, Steve, is this the disease of the modern age, in a way that I don't think is necessarily that useful or interesting on either side. I feel really, really bad saying it, because it's obvious that his problems are very real and anguishing to him, and many people who have them will probably identify reading the book. But this is not a genre of memoir that I enjoy reading.
Right. Well, Julia, it seems to me Dana's put her finger on it exactly, right? That a problem confronting him was that, on the one hand, he wants to write about the condition is he suffers from it, which is totally in extremis, right? He is massively, massively beset by anxiety to a pathological degree. On the other hand, he wants to write about it as a kind of universal condition. We all suffer from it in varying degrees, and maybe it even is a description of what it's like to be conscious and human. But those two things don't necessarily go with one another, do they?
Right. It's a little tricky to focus on your own extreme experience and then also inquire whether this is just the state of modern life. You know, one other thing that's a little difficult to tell from reading an excerpt is he runs through in a very interesting way many of the various theories about anxiety and its causes. Is anxiety spiritual? Is anxiety chemical? Is anxiety, you know, is it sort of a Freudian response to whatever the failings were of our childhoods? He sort of runs through the many different ways in which humankind has strived to process anxiety over the years, and then weaves through it many sad and horrifying stories from his own struggle. But right, it's a little bit hard to figure out who the audience is for this book. I mean, certainly if you struggle intensely with anxiety, I'm sure it would be interesting although possibly anxiety-provoking, to encounter the struggles of someone else. If you know and love someone who has intense anxiety, perhaps it would be enlightening or illuminating. But it doesn't sound like he... It sounds like he weighs the literature and weaves through it in a very interesting way, but doesn't really come down with a current modern theory of what's really going on. Which, you know, that the Louis Menand review of the book is lacerating. I mean, it comes around to concluding that Scott Stossel is a brave and daring man, but oof. If I were an anxious person, it would make me much more anxious to read a review that calls me out for misciting the year that Freud said something in a ruthless parenthetical and also says that the subject and the book itself are a bit of a mess. Eek. But in some ways, Menand's critique, which is that he needed to sort of pick a theory of anxiety and argue for it, is interesting and would make for a more satisfying read. On the other hand, I think part of the problem here is that anxiety is a very broad term that means a lot of different things to a lot of different people and that we all experience in many different ways in our own lives, and that these various possible ways to think about and process anxiety and the various causes to which we can attribute it, some of them may apply in different ways to different people and to different symptoms, you know? So it's just amorphous and a little bit hard to pin down. And I'm not sure it's fair to expect Stossel to have come up with a grand unifying theory of modern anxiety.
I believe it's basically heroic for him to have done this. I thought it was an admirable piece of writing for many reasons, one of which is that it doesn't seem divvied up in order to garner clicks and move units. It sounds like a more or less honest inventory from someone who is, we should say, super high-functioning and self-aware. Where I get a little less on board was when the condition is turned into a bit of a literary superpower by the end of the excerpt, and then from a literary superpower into a bit of a self-help cliché. You know, he talks about all of the great writers and thinkers who've suffered from anxiety. And at that point, maybe the condition has been so generalized out to mean an ability to think as a kind of anxious steward of one's own future. I'm not so sure that anxiety is what Proust and you name it, Einstein or whoever else it is. I'm not sure that it's the central thing that they all had in common. It's going to cripple as many people as it enables. But I did appreciate that there is some attempt to reckon with the arc of the history of anxiety, that it was felt especially acutely in the post-war years, which is when it was picked up by the existentialists and turned into a kind of totemic thing. And then it kind of went deaf, dumb, and blind for a generation or two when depression became really the prevailing metaphor or medical diagnosis for thinking about the discontents with modern life. But for all we know, he does it in the book, which I'm curious to take a look at and see how he treated it there. All right. Well, now is the moment in our show where we endorse Dana. What do you have?
Well, I think I'm going to go out on a limb and endorse the single best movie I saw at Sundance last week. And that's going some, because I saw 21 movies in 8 days and it was really intense and quite a lot of them were good. But I'm going to endorse one that actually doesn't have distribution that I can tell and may be really hard to track down. So this is something for listeners to keep their eyes open for. If they happen to be going to a film festival in Telluride or Abu Dhabi, they're in luck because they can see this movie. But otherwise, you may have to really hunt for it. It's called Ida. Spelled IDA, the title, and it's a Polish movie directed by Paweł Pawlikowski. I believe it came out in 2013, and it is just a compact gem of perfection, just a beautiful, beautiful movie that in some ways evokes Robert Bresson, maybe. It's about religion and faith. It's the story of a young nun in Poland who's trying to find out truths about her family background and what happened to her family during the Second World War. It's in black and white, and it's just, there's not a frame or a sound in this movie that I would change. It's just a total marvel. So Paweł Pawlikowski's Ida, keep your eyes out for it.
Oh, wow. I'm psyched to see it. Julia, what do you have?
Well, it would be foolish to endorse the Met as a museum, since I think museum goers the world over would agree. It's obviously one of the world's, I don't know, 4 or 5 top museums. And so obviously it's good and you should go there. But I think more specifically, I would like to endorse the experience of going to a museum with no particular goal in mind. I feel like I'm a very show-driven museum goer. I like to go see a recently curated show that's gotten interesting reviews and look at a retrospective or a set of works that are all put in some order for some specific purpose with a nice little story to run you through it. And I've gone to the Met a couple times in recent weekends, and it's really fun to just noodle around and find little weird corners and, you know, just spend 45 minutes finding something beautiful and mesmerizing that you never looked at before. And I was struck this past weekend by some paintings from the 15th century, a bunch of them by David Ghirlandaio. There's just a little room full of 15th century faces, and it's right around that moment in painting where faces suddenly become very specific and very human and very full of particularity and life and soul. And it was a transporting little museum moment. So my endorsement is go to the museum nearest you with no goal in mind and find some little corner that transports you.
Oh, that's beautiful.
I like that endorsement. That is wonderful. All right, well, this Scott Stossel piece and the Louis Menand review both brought to mind the work by the poet W.H. Auden, which was considered the great work of the Age of Anxiety, called The Age of Anxiety. The problem with it was a very hard piece of literature to groove on, even though I liked Auden, so it got me thinking about which of his poems I really do like. And my favorite is In Sickness and in Health. If people are ever looking for something to read at a wedding, it turns out there's precious less than you would expect poetry that comes off as completely appropriate to read at a wedding. But this is a wonderful one. It's clearly meant from its title to be a kind of set of vows. Rejoice, dear love, in love's peremptory word. All chance, all love, all logic. You and I exist by grace of the absurd. It's just a wonderful poem. The lie of our divinity afresh described round our chaotic malice now. The arbitrary circle of a vow. It's a beautiful poem. It's probably my favorite by W.H. Auden. Check it out.
Epithalamium. You know that word, Steve?
Oh, my gosh. I think I do. Is it a wedding poem?
Yeah, I think it's an ode to a marriage. It's an occasional poem written to be read at a wedding.
What a great word. I didn't know that word.
Yeah, Dana drops the bomb. I love it. All right, well, Dana Stevens, thank you so much.
Thanks, Steve.
Julia, thank you. That was a delight.
Thanks, Steve.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about on today's program at wnyc.org/gabfest, and you can also leave a comment there. And you'll find the longer podcast versions of our shows on iTunes, SoundCloud, or in the WNYC iPhone app. Just search for Slate Gabfest. Gabfest Radio is a production of Slate.com, which is solely responsible for its content. The producers are Ann Hepperman and Mike Vuolo. Our interns are Rebecca Cohen and Anna Schechtman. The executive producer is Andy Bowers. For everyone on the Gabfest crew, I'm Stephen Metcalf, and we'll talk to you next week.